Well, hey guys, good to have you here today as we begin a brand new series we're calling Reconstructing Faith. And in this series, we're going to be looking at Jesus, like just Jesus himself, as our foundation of understanding and perhaps redefining what our faith means to us in this modern world that we live in. This series is really an investigation into a couple of things: who Jesus is, what he told us about God, and what he actually told us to do. Or what we're going to do is peel back the layers of tradition, right, and interpretation and an assumption to get to the heart of Jesus's message. And my hope as we go through the series is that we rediscover Jesus in a way that challenges us, comforts us, and compels us to live out his teachings in our everyday life. So let me begin with a question here. And that question is, what's required to be a Christian? What's required to be a Christian? In other words, what do I have to believe, right? What is the things that I have to do? Is there anything that I have to stop doing? Is there anything I have to start doing? And depending on your church background, you might have some different ideas about all of these things that we're doing. And it might be hard to determine what is essential things, like what's essential to following Jesus, because every denomination, every movement, and sometimes even individual churches seem to add their own set of things that are essential to being a Christian, right? They have their own set of traditions. If you grew up in church, you know this, right? They have their own expectations on how you behave. They have their own expectations on how you worship. And in some cases, they may even have their own translations of the Bible and their own interpretations of their translations of the Bible. So, the question is, what's actually required, right? What is actually indispensable, necessary, and crucial to being a Christian, to being a faithful follower of Jesus? But maybe even equally as important is what's not. Like, what's peripheral, or what's just cultural? You know, that's just the way we do it in our culture, and before long, we think, well, those things are now essential. Or what's comfortable, right? This is how our church has always done it, but that's not necessarily essential. Or what's fashionable, right? What's trendy? This is trendy church, and so this is trendy church, this is the way to be a Christian. Or what's traditional, right? And if you leave traditional, well, maybe somehow you're leaving what's actually true and leaving the actual faith. And believe it or not, this is nothing new, right? This type of thing has been going on since the church began over 2,000 years ago. In every generation, new, novel, sometimes toxic, sometimes cruel, sometimes divisive, even dangerous teachings and opinions, they can get woven into certain streams of Christianity. And these new, novel ideas, they get often elevated to the status of doctrine or dogma, right? This is what you have to do. And then they get woven into theology. This is what we said, say God says, and this is what God is like. And before we know it, these new non-essential things, they become essential. And when you begin to question, or in some cases, out and out reject some of these non-essentials, people in your faith movement, they might consider you maybe like a lesser Christian or an unfaithful church person. But when we return to the Gospels and we look at Jesus' life, his actions and his priorities, it becomes evident that many of these issues are, in fact, just add-ons. And what's worse is that maybe some of the things that actually are essential to following Jesus, they end up being completely ignored. And the true essence of Christianity, they can get overshadowed by debates and online arguments over non-essentials, leading to division rather than to the unity that we are called to in our faith in Jesus. And this is the epidemic the church is facing today. Every day, more and more Christians are finding themselves at a crossroads, feeling compelled to leave their church due to the experiences or the teachings that they felt that are profoundly out of step with the understanding of Jesus' message. And for some, it was multiple encounters with legalism or judgment or hypocrisy within the church. For others, it's the result of harmful advice or actions taken by church leaders or other Christians. And so this happens, and they begin to think, well, I'm not sure Jesus would act that way. I'm not sure that Jesus would support that view, or he would support that stance. And so, without any other options, they feel the only choice they have is to leave the church. And the decision to leave a church, especially when it's the only version of Christianity that you know, it can lead to leaving Christianity altogether. And in that quest to escape something that's unhealthy or harmful, you might inadvertently distance yourself from the aspects of faith that are meaningful and are life-giving. Look, I've had probably 15 to 20 of these conversations so far this year. Stories of people who've left their church because of a rejection of some add-on to faith. Stories of people who left their church because of a profound sense of betrayal and disillusionment. And in almost every one of those conversations, there is some version of this question. Is there any value to being a Christian? Is there any value to being a Christian? In other words, does Christianity, stripped of all the add-ons, the denominational institutional baggage, and all that non-essential stuff, does it offer anything valuable and important? And my answer is always going to be a resounding yes. But finding the value often requires a journey back to the basics of Jesus' teachings, a journey characterized by grace and love and forgiveness. And that's what we're going to do in this series. We're going to go back to Jesus. We're going to go back to the Gospels, back to what Jesus said about God, back to what he asks us to do, and we're going to strip away, best we can, anything and everything that is non-essential so that we can discover what actually is essential. And if you've been in church for a while, this can be pretty difficult to do. Because you grew up with a certain way of thinking about God. You grew up with a list of things that are essential for faith. And so you kind of have, if you could picture it, like a God box. And in that God box is your operating manual for God. And for us, this is how God operates. And this is how God thinks. Therefore, you feel like you just can't question what's in your God box. But here's something I want you to understand. A faith that can't be questioned can't be trusted. A faith that can't be questioned, it can't be trusted. Because at some point along the way, all of us are going to have questions, right? And that's totally okay. In fact, it's actually important because, let's be real, if your faith can't handle a few tough questions, then something is really off. If your God can't handle some questions, you need a new God, I guess, right? Here's the kicker. In a lot of faith circles, asking these big, scary questions feels like you're walking away from your faith. And asking those questions in some churches, they can get you looked at kind of funny or gossiped about or worse. It might even get you kicked out. All for wondering out loud probably what everyone else in the room is thinking. So if we're in one of those environments and we begin to have questions, rather than facing those strange looks or risk getting kicked out, we feel like our only option is to just step away from church so that we can ask those questions. But it feels like, well, there's no room at my church to figure out what's actually going on. You know, is it just tradition? Is it this? Is it that? Is it just, well, we've always done it this way, or that's how grandma liked it, right? So we step away. Karen Armstrong, she's written a lot of books about comparative religion. She grew up a Roman Catholic and even spent her early adult years in a convent, during which she kind of went through this struggle with her church and ended up just kind of pushing her away from organized religion. But she's written a lot of books around comparative religion. And she says in her book, The Case for God, she makes this statement. She says, many of us have been left stranded with an incoherent concept of God. We learned about God about the same time that we were told about the Santa Claus. But while our understanding of the Santa Claus phenomena evolved and matured, our theology remained somewhat infantile. Right? And as I was reading that statement, I just kept thinking, we have to leave room for the harder questions of faith. We have to be able to talk about those things inside of us that cause us to question God or to question our faith. And at the same time, I know that we will not get all of our questions answered. In fact, I think I have more questions now than when I had my faith crisis back in 2007. And just like we heard from Jeremy when he was baptized a couple of weeks ago here at Next Level, I'm finally okay with not having all of my questions answered. But I'm also not comfortable with not being able to ask my questions or not being able to talk about them. Because here's what I've learned. This is how faith grows up. It is vitally important that our faith grow up with us. Because here's what I have observed. A faith that's not allowed to grow up will be deconstructed, intentionally or eventually. A faith that isn't given the room to mature and consider the broader, complex world that we live in is on a path to unraveling. And this unraveling might happen because someone chooses to step back and start wrestling with the big questions, or it might just fall apart because a faith that remains kind of stuck in kids' church simply can't stand up to the complexity and hardships of adult life. In other words, if we don't actively expand and challenge our beliefs, the harsh realities of life will do it for us. And a faith that hasn't evolved to face the brokenness of the world that we live in is too fragile, because life, with its unrelenting challenges, is just too much of a simplistic, unexamined belief system. Without scrutiny and growth, your faith will hit a dead end. Like, imagine always being told that you're a David, facing down your Goliaths, all right? Be it your Goliath of health issues or fears or financial problems, relationship problems, marriage problems, right? And the promise is that God will bring you victory. But what happens when Goliath keeps winning? What happens when Goliath's been winning for a few months or years, a decade? You start to wonder, well, what am I doing wrong? And when your personal experience doesn't seem to fit with the biblical narratives if they've been taught to you, it can kind of leave you feeling like you're drowning, right? Questioning why your reality doesn't match up to the stories you've been told from the Bible. And if any of this resonates with you, I've got some really encouraging news. Read the Gospels. And when you do, you'll notice Jesus consistently sought out, engaged with people just like you. People who felt like let down by the religious structure of the day, right? And the promises that fell flat. Jesus just didn't wait for these folks to come to him. He actively sought them out. He had a special concern for their disillusionment, right? People who were disillusioned by the religious system. So if you're feeling disconnected from the faith traditions that you grew up with, or if you're questioning whether the church culture that you were raised in really aligns with the harsh realities of life, know that you're not alone, right? And there's absolutely nothing wrong with you. Your maturity and willingness to ask tough questions, even if it means stepping back to gain perspective, shows a depth of faith, not a lack of it. You might have taken a step back, but your openness to still lean into these questions, that speaks volumes. So with the time that I've got remaining, what I want to do is look at one of these core issues that we must wrestle with as we reconstruct our faith as adults. And I want to go back to where we left off last week at Easter, because it's critical to figure this one thing out in the beginning, because everything after this just builds on this. And the thing that we need to resolve is, who is Jesus? We talked about it last week. Who is Jesus? Now, as we start, what I want you to do is imagine, go back in time to the year 30 AD. And back at that time, there's no concept of church as we know it today, right? There's no leather-bound Bibles sitting on shelves. There's no Christian worship songs filling the air, no bands, no youth group, no developed Christian theology to study. The religious landscape in that time was dominated by the Torah, the temple, the authority of the priests, and the heavy presence of a Roman occupation. And amidst that backdrop, there's an unconventional rabbi from Nazareth causing quite a stir. He's attracting huge crowds. He's telling stories and parables that are just as enlightening as they are perplexing. He's challenging the status quo and openly criticizing the corruption that's so prominent inside of the temple system and in the broader religious context. This rabbi, Jesus, is a figure of controversy. Some people are drawn to him, other people hate him, many people are just bewildered by his teachings. Now, I want you to imagine that you get to listen in on this conversation that Jesus is about to have with his disciples. Right, so about 2.5 years into his ministry, and we find him and his 12 disciples in Caesarea Philippi, a region that is far removed from the religious epicenter of Jerusalem. And amidst that backdrop, Jesus and his disciples are having a conversation, and this conversation is critical to our understanding of who Jesus is, because it's here that Jesus poses a question that cuts to the heart of what it means to follow him, a question that echoes through the ages and even challenges us today. So we're going to go to Matthew chapter 16, start with verse 13. It says, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? So he asks his disciples, hey, you're out there about around the crowd, who do the people say the Son of Man is? Now that title, Son of Man, is one that Jesus often gives himself. And by doing so, what he's doing, he's connecting himself to a title that the prophet Daniel says is someone who has divine authority, someone destined to judge the nations, which is kind of an audacious claim that Jesus is making, unless it's true. And in verse 14, the disciples, they kind of talk about the rumors and the speculations that are going around. And so in verse 14, it says, well, they replied, some say you're John the Baptist, some say Elijah, and others say Jeremiah, or one of the other prophets. And it's clear that people are seeing Jesus as a figure of significant spiritual power, yet they're struggling to kind of fully grasp his identity. So he listens to what the other people are saying, and then Jesus does what he does. He turns the question directly on his own disciples. Then he asks them, but who do you say I am? Who do you say I am? That's great, what everybody else is saying, but who do you say I am? And this isn't just some casual conversation they're having. This is about the foundation of everything that follows in the Christian faith. And then Peter, he seems to be one of the first to jump up at everything. He speaks up and he says, Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Now, this is a declaration that changes everything, because this marks a turning point in understanding Jesus' identity, who he is, and what his mission is. This moment gives us a profound revelation about the nature of Jesus and the essence of the Christian faith. Peter tells us Jesus is not just a wise teacher. He's not a prophetic figure. He is the Messiah, the one through whom God would accomplish something entirely new and world-changing. When he names Jesus as the Messiah, he is invoking a deeply rooted expectation of a promised deliverer, anointed by God for a special purpose to be the king and the ruler over all. Peter's statement recognizes Jesus as the ultimate king, not just of a nation, but of all humanity. He's declaring that Jesus is the Son of God. Now, consider the gravity of this acknowledgement. Peter is saying that Jesus embodies God's kingdom on earth, that in Jesus God has chosen to manifest his kingship in a tangible, walkable, relatable form. And this isn't about a temporary earthly kingdom, it's about the eternal breaking into the present through Jesus. Now, regardless of your faith system, regardless of whether or not you're a Christian, I just want you to think for just a minute right here. What if this is truly who Jesus is? What if he is indeed the divine king and the representative of God to humanity? Because if he is, his presence on earth changes everything. If he is, it's not enough to acknowledge him as just some historical figure or profound teacher. If Jesus is who Peter claims, he becomes the axis on which our entire understanding of life, purpose, and eternity rotates. Jesus ceases to be one reference point among many. He becomes the reference point, the defining reality of existence. If what Peter says is true, there's only one response, and that is no matter what Jesus asks, the answer is yes, because he is king. He is everything. Acknowledging who Jesus is and getting that right is critical. Now, I want you to look at what Jesus responds to Peter. He makes this audacious statement, and then Jesus says, you are blessed, Simon, son of John, because my Father in heaven has revealed this to you. You did not learn this from human being. He doesn't look. He doesn't go, oh, Peter, well, you went way too far. He doesn't diminish the moment. He doesn't back away from the way. Like, no, 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 Peter, let's not get crazy with it. Instead, he affirms it. He declares that Peter is blessed for having this revelation and that it came to him not through his own human wisdom, but through divine insight. And this exchange underscores a critical truth. Recognizing Jesus' true identity, it's not about intellectual achievement, right? It's about spiritual revelation. It's not about just figuring it out intellectually. It's a spiritual revelation. So when Jesus gives Peter kind of that nod of approval, he's saying his insight was only possible because God revealed it to him. And in it, it's like he's flipping on the switch of how we're supposed to see faith. Faith is not about just ticking off boxes or following rules. It's about having this vision that goes way past what's right in front of our eyes. It's about a deep dive into the reality of who Jesus is. He's actually the ultimate ruler, the one who's at the very heart of everything we are and everything we do. Imagine faith as a journey where you're not just looking at Jesus through a historical or religious lens, but you're seeing him as the main character in the story of life. Is if Jesus is saying, hey, seeing me as the Lord and King isn't just about believing I existed or did some cool stuff back in the day. It's about understanding that I'm still active and central to everything now. It's kind of like this. I don't know if you're into gaming. I'm into gaming. Jesus isn't just some other random NPC that you meet along the path that gives you side quests. He's more like the game designer, the one who created the entire game, all of the rules, and yet he's also playing the game right there with you, guiding you through every level. This is the heart of faith. Jesus is talking about, right, and this is understanding a big, major truth, and that is Jesus isn't just a part of life. He is the point of life. Right? It's not just a part of things. He is the point of things. It's realizing that everything from the mundane stuff to what you're having for breakfast to the big life questions about purpose and destiny, right? All of this orbits around him. So when Peter gets this kind of thumbs up from Jesus, it's a big deal. It's like Jesus is saying, you get it. You're not just following me because I'm a good teacher or because you think I'll overthrow the Romans. You're with me because you see the bigger picture. Right? I'm here to shake up all that is known or will be known. I'm here to redefine what life and power and kingship really mean. So this isn't Peter, right? This isn't about Peter being some super genius or having some secret spiritual goggles that he can see things. It's about him being open to a truth that's bigger than what his eyes can see. A truth that's handed down not by human wisdom, but through a spiritual connection with God. And that, my friends, is the kind of faith journey Jesus is inviting all of us on as well. One where we see him not just as some historical figure, but as the living Lord and King, the central force of existence. And let me ask you again, what if it's true? Like, I believe it's true, but maybe you're not there yet. So let's just ask, what if it's true? If this is true, how should we act? We should probably act the way they acted, right? They believed. And the good news for us is, just like us, they would also have another time of unbelief, right? A moment where their faith would be questioned and tested, another chance for their faith to be expanded and strengthened. Because in this moment, they're all in with Jesus. But in just a few short months, they're all going to have second thoughts and walk away. Why is that? Well, it turns out they have their own little God box. You know, we talked about your God box. They had a God box, that mental container where we shove all our ideas about God and how God should act. And in their God box, they always win. All right, God's guy doesn't get knocked down. He's supposed to always come out on top. But then Jesus ends up on a cross. And suddenly their God box doesn't make sense anymore, right? Their Messiah, their ultimate winner, well, he lost. That wasn't part of the plan. So they bail, and they take their God box with them, and they unfollow Jesus because the story didn't match their expectations. But when Jesus rose from the dead, everything changed. In those moments, they realized, wow, our God box was way too tiny. They realized they had it wrong. Their box was outdated. It was kind of stuck in tradition. It wasn't even close to what God was really doing. And with this new, unboxed version of faith, they went out and they turned the world upside down. And that's why we are here today. Because the resurrection, it becomes the cornerstone that shapes and defines everything else within Christianity. It's the reason that every morning I feel compelled to open my Bible and immerse myself in the teachings of Jesus or reflect on the insights of those who were closest to him. Because where else would I want to start my day? Like, what's more crucial? What's more life-altering than turning to the words of God's chosen King? In the midst of our busy lives and the myriad of voices clamoring for our attention, dedicating time to listen to Jesus is not only beneficial, it's essential. It isn't just another item on my to-do list. It's tapping into the source of what everything is really about. So while as a church we might bicker about the nitty-gritty of church life or theological fine points, at the end of the day, this one agreement puts everything else in perspective. It's the one chord that no matter how out of tune we get with each other, this one chord somehow brings us all back into harmony. So, who is Jesus? What is that one chord? Jesus is God's Son and our King. Understanding that Jesus is God's Son and our King is the absolute starting point of following him. And maybe you need to take a moment and really let that sink in. Like, Jesus is exactly who he said he was. He is God's Son and our King. His early followers understood that. They got it. Then they doubted, right? Because, hello, messiahs aren't supposed to die. But when Jesus resurrected from the dead, they were all in again. They realized, yep, this guy is the real deal. He is God's Son, God's chosen ruler. Now, for us, what do we do with this? I mean, if Jesus really is who he claims to be, what's our move? Like, if this really is true, if he's God's Son and our King, what choice do we have but to go all in, to surrender, to worship, to just say yes to whatever he's asking? Right? It's not about having a debate. It's about seeing the ultimate act of love, God sending his Son for us to cover a debt we could never handle on our own. And if that doesn't make you want to stop everything and just follow, I don't know what will. Because here's the thing. If Jesus is God's King, and he's out here loving us, rooting for us, and has literally laid everything on the line for us, our response should write itself. We bow down. Not in a you're the boss way, but in a my heart is yours way. Like, I'm about to surrender, yes, but it's the kind of surrender that feels like freedom. It's choosing to follow him because in the grand scheme, that's the only move that makes the difference. And so, as we start reconstructing our faith, accepting and submitting to Jesus as the King is the foundation. Because if you get this part solid, you'll be golden. Everything we do, everything we believe, it all spirals from this core truth. If you're clear on Jesus being the Son of God and our King, you're on the right track. All the other stuff, there's still plenty of important stuff out there, and we'll dive into some of those things over the next couple of weeks. But remember, getting this core truth locked down is what sets the stage for everything else. It's like the main melody in a complex piece of music. You get the melody right, and all the harmonies just fall into place. Hey, let's pray together. Heavenly Father, we're standing at a crossroads here. And we think about Jesus and who he is, that he's your Son and our King. And if we take this truth to heart, it seems like our next steps are pretty clear. Our only real option is to dive in head first, to say yes to whatever you're asking us, to surrender fully, to worship deeply, and to follow wherever he leads. So here we are, choosing to bow down, not out of some sort of obligation, not because it's something that we're supposed to do, but because our hearts are wholly yours. This surrender is not much about as much about us giving up as it is us about gaining everything. We're not just saying you're the boss, we're saying our hearts completely belong to you, completely. This kind of surrender is the kind of thing that brings freedom, that shows us the way to truly live. Following Jesus, going all in, that's what makes the difference in our lives. So God, help us to live this out. To be people who not just say we believe, but be people who live like we do. People who follow Jesus with everything we are because we know it's the best, most life-giving move we can make. Father, thanks for being patient with us and for loving us and for leading us closer to you every single day. In Jesus' name, we pray. Well, hey, friends, thanks for joining us today. If you think today's message might be valuable to someone you know, would you mind sharing this video? Not only could it be helpful for them, but by sharing this content as well as liking and subscribing to this channel, you're helping us accomplish our mission to raise the reputation of Jesus. And along those lines, each and every week, I ask, could you help us out financially by heading over to our website at nextlevelchurch.org. Click the green give button and choose one of the giving options that's there. It's your faithful financial support that helps us create content like this and continues to raise the reputation of Jesus where we live, work, and play. Now, by way of benediction, let me reread to you Matthew 16:16, where Simon Peter says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." May you walk confidently in the light of this revelation. And may you allow it to shape your every action and decision with courage and grace. Hey guys, have a blessed week. We'll see you back next week as we continue on our series, Reconstructing Faith.